Digital Free Thought Radio Hour.
First I was a Catholic girl, loved the mass, I watched the swirl of smoke from candles burning, while Mary looked up yearning. I got confirmed and I confessed, I really felt that I was blessed. Plus I loved my uniform, so did the boy who lived next door. But something changed when I became of age, and all those things I thought were true, someday I'd break the big taboo.
This is Digital Free Thought Radio Hour. I'm trying to adjust my volumes here, and it doesn't seem to be working. But we have trouble every time, seems like. This is the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO Radio 103.9 LPFM here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm Doubter 5, and with us we have Riv. Say hello, Riv.
Hello.
I can hear you good. And Wombat, are you on there? Hey, welcome, Wombat. We have Wombat on the phone. He lives in Kentucky, so he has to come in virtually. Digital Free Thought Radio is, that's right, is a talk radio atheist show. It talks about atheism, free thought, rational thought, humanism, and the sciences. And conversely, we also talk about religion, religious faiths, God's holy books, and superstition. And I'm still not getting the volume out of here that I think I should be getting. But let's go with the little game then. Okay. If you get the feeling that you're the only non-believer in Knoxville, well, you're just wrong. There are several atheist and rationalist groups that exist here in Knoxville, and I'll be telling you about them a little bit later on in the show and how you can connect with them. Also, did you know that there is an atheist call-in television show broadcasting here in Knoxville? Did you know that, Wombat? That's true. But it's not true. I mean, we do have a show, but it's nothing like that. Riv, you know all about it.
I do. Actually, I was saying,
can you hear Wombat? You can't. I can hear him, but which is weird.
I think the wires are just a little sensitive, probably.
I'm hearing you pretty well right now. Excuse us, folks. I'm not getting any lights at all when Wombat talks, so let's see what may be happening here. Not on mute. Try it again, Wombat. Wombat. Wombat, you're not going out. I'm going to, hold on, let's try this again. Try it again. Say something, Wombat. No, it's got to be this new case I've got on my phone. Hold on. Sorry, folks. This is live radio. Welcome.
The technology, it helps and it hinders.
It sure does.
Oh, into the show. How about that?
Oh, there you are.
There we are.
It was the case. It was keeping the connection from being made. Let me get a sound level on you. Okay.
Hey, 865-333-5937.
That's
I can
right.
Call in anytime.
All right, 333-5937. Call in with your questions and or comments. And you're ready to go if you want to start again there. Wombat.
I'm saying I know exactly what you're talking about. You can try to mute me. The truth will not be denied. This is a show. There's guys with laser vision. There's people that can control electricity. There's a guy with these claws. I'm talking about a school full of all these mutated kids. I don't know why I haven't heard about the show before. It's amazing. Amazing movies. I can't get enough of it. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Wrong. The Atheist Call-In Show is called Free Thought Forum, and it's been broadcasting here in Knoxville for almost 7 years now. And we'll tell you how you can listen to that and watch it, maybe even interact with it a little bit later on in the show. Right now, if you'd like to call in the show and share your opinions with us and or questions, you can call at 865-333-5937, 865-333-5937. And despite what Steve Martin would have you think, there are an awful lot of atheist songs out there, and you'll be hearing some of them right here in this program and generally on rotation. However, if you go to digitalfreethought.com, click on the blog, and then look for the atheist music that I have there, you can find 60 or 70 atheist songs right there. So, we were talking about a little topic earlier in the week. I'm not really sure how to label that topic or give it a title. Would you like to give it a shot there, Wombat?
Oh, man. How dare you just leave this on my library? So I think you called to me, and what you had was a manifesto. And I think the main title of it was, hey, people who believe, this is why I don't believe. And there was some pretty good stuff there. And I think maybe that's a pretty good start. More or less, you started a conversation online with an article discussing why you didn't believe in God. And why don't you go from there? I can't put my words.
Well, no. All I did was just basically tried to. The title of the article was The History of the World. Not very grandiose or anything. Not like I was going to encompass everything there is. No, but what I was going to do was basically...
Ooh, better call Heston about that.
Yeah.
Sorry, good.
No, it seems like every time I talk to a believer online, you know, a Facebook post or something, they always come up, well, where do you think we came from? Where do you think life comes from? You know, that type of thing. How did we get here on Earth? And they literally have no idea. I mean, you can say evolution, and to them, you might as well just be saying abracadabra. They don't understand. They don't know. But the thing about it is, what they don't realize is how spectacularly life arrived on the planet. And I wrote an article on it explaining that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. You can get your mind over the number 4.5. You can kind of drop the billions. But with the first billion... there was no life on Earth, nothing, maybe just replicating chemicals, and that was about it. When I say replicating chemicals, I mean you have chemicals leaching from the rocks, you have chemicals falling from the sky. They found amino acids floating in space, so they could just fall on Earth. And you get regular chemical reactions that form molecules, form compounds, and through regular chemical reaction, you have sometimes you get strings of chemicals that can replicate themselves, that can literally make copies of themselves. And the first copies were the first thing that would make copies, I think, was RNA.
RNA.
And
basic proteins.
Basic protein. And I wrote that. And for the first billion years of Earth, there was no life, or maybe even just chemicals that were replicating a kind of a pre-life. But then you had some chemicals that through regular processes had begun to get coatings around them, which protected them from the outside dangers from the other chemicals in the water. It was the first type of thing that we would call a cell. You had the inside of the cell, which was the RNA, and then you had outside the cell, which was other cells or just chemical soup. And the ones that had the cells lasted longer and were able to make more copies of themselves. So pretty much it started using up the soup.
And not to mention you have constantly being bombarded by cosmic rays, and they're just adding to the pot of mixtures.
And electricity through the form of lightning and heat from the Earth. There's lots of different forms of energy were pouring into the Earth about that time. Now, that single cells, the single cells that made up the first life on Earth, lasted for the next 3 billion years. So you have the first billion with no life, or little or no life. The second the next period of 3 billion years out of 4.5, we're single-celled animals. I mean, that's it. That's all the work. And then the Cambrian explosion happened, and an incredible explosion of different varied types of life, plants and animals, anything from single cells to accumulations of single cells like sponges and jellyfish. But they weren't sentient at all. They had no senses. All they did was just clump together and filter the water, basically. But from then on, you had more and more complex life being evolved in the soups of the oceans. And then, of course, some of the plants started migrating up out of the water. Plants can do that since they just need sunlight, for photosynthesis. But then it wasn't long before there were some fish that, fish get oxygen from the water. It's dissolved oxygen in the water, and they use gills to do it. But if you're a fish and you live in a low oxygen area, you either die or you adapt. And some of these fish adapted to be able to get oxygen from the air in addition to their lungs, their gills. And before long, they started moving out of the water onto the land. And then you have regular evolution taking over, and you have fish to reptiles to mammals to us. And it was just like all within the last half a billion years, the last 500 million years. And to put it into perspective, the dinosaurs were around for, 150 million years?
Yeah, it was
a long, long, long time, but they died out 65 million years ago. The thing about it is, we've only been around for one-tenth of 1 million years. 100,000 years, maybe 150,000 years. So compared to us, the dinosaurs are very successful species, very successful, I'll get it right in a minute, life form. Who knows what would happen if the asteroid hadn't hit. But anyway, that's what I was trying to do, just bring that up. Go ahead, Rip.
There's a couple of interesting things, I think. One is the one super survivor that doesn't get enough attention, I think, is it called the Tartagran?
No, I haven't heard of it.
It's this eight or so odd, a little microscopic creature which can survive in lava. It can survive in the dead of absence of...
like a little bear, bear.
Yeah. And yeah. So it's been noted that aliens observing from the outside might think it's a planet of those species just because there's so many of them. But also a note of numbers. I think sometimes when talking to people about the scale of time that has passed relative to our observation... in our little pocket of gravity and so on and so on. The concept of thousands of years might be able to be digested. I can follow that. The Bible says, 6,000. I can follow that. But then we start talking about hundreds of thousands of years and millions and billions. It becomes kind of like maybe like a kill switch. That's just ridiculous. But something to help bridge that gap, I find, is just to do a small little step where you say, okay, I can imagine living for 100 years, and then I can imagine living another 100 years. Think of some of the things you'd be doing that time. I can imagine living for another 100 years. And you work yourself up over the course of 20 minutes or so through reasoning yourself, and you're saying, yeah, I can imagine this much time passing. But that's just, maybe that doesn't work, maybe it doesn't. But.
Yeah. So what were you going to say about that, Wombat? About the article?
All I have to say is, sure, all I have to say is one thing. Praise God. Isn't he wonderful? Making the universe just like the way you said it, with 4.8 or 4.5 billions of years of Earth formation and the development of an RNA molecule that could eventually lead to peptides and the eventual formation through selective processes to lead to where we're at today. Amazing.
Yeah, are you really a dispensationalist, Wombat? Is that what you are?
Hey, what I'm saying is, there was a time where I believed all of that, and I also believed in God. So I guess what the point is, okay, great. How does that change my religious beliefs? Because last time I checked, this is an atheist radio show. Not so much just science, but hey, how is that supposed to convince someone who does believe in a God and all the things that you said were true and make them lose faith or make them think about their religious process?
Well,
that's the question.
One of the things is they can no longer, if this is true, and there's ample evidence to show that it's true. You can take college courses. You can even audit college courses if you want to, and find the evidence for it and see the evidence, see how they test it, see how they reach their conclusions. And if you give that credence, if you understand it and say, well, that has to be true, then there are things in the Bible that you have to drop. Genesis is one of them, Adam and Eve, all that type of thing. The formation of the earth, the time scale. I mean, you can try to work around it like they did in the Scopes trial. You know, say when one day equals 10 million years or something like that. But that wouldn't work if you're talking about creating plants first and then the sun on the third day. How can the plants live for, you know, billions of years or millions without a sun?
I've heard that spun in that it's actually on the fourth day.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sun, the moon, right, in the stars. It's actually representative of like the spirit. It's like the Trinity or something.
Well,
I heard that spun before.
They don't even have to spin it. All they got to do is say God can do anything. He can make plants live without sun. But it's just if you're going to give science credence at all, then you have to give up some of the religious claims that you find in the Bible.
So the only thing I want to highlight is actually two things. One, I want to take more of an epistemological approach towards this because, truthfully, about 7 years ago, I was in college, second year, as a biochemistry major, and I believed everything that you just, you know, illustrated to a degree, mm-hmm. plus more detail, and I still had my faith in God completely and wholly true. Uh-huh. And I can guarantee you right now, there are people even in my own laboratory that still hold on to their beliefs. And this is after multiple years of not only believing all these things, getting their degrees, but also working in a scientific lab. So clearly there's a conflict going on. And I don't disagree. I won't say that's not the case. There's definitely a conflict in thought. What's more concerning though is, say for example, and I'm going to posit a question to you. I hope, and it's not a trick question, but scientists right now say, you know, like the earth, like we all got here, animals, the reason why there's so many different animals and how humans are eventually on the planet was due to evolution. And would you say that finding through science is one of the reasons why you don't believe in a God? Not a trick question.
Well, it gives me, look, this is what I like to say about early sciences. When believers come to me and say, you know, Isaac Newton didn't believe in evolution. Well, there was no evolution when he was around. They talk about Copernicus and some
just
other people
we get into,
that believe in God but also believe in science. Well, what I'm saying
doubt
is...
Doubt or five. There's a really bad stereotype among atheists in that they're really, really bad at answering questions, which makes it really, really easy for theists to just come in with the simplest answer, God, and then a lot of people are swayed by them. So really, it's not a trick question, but let's say there's a list of scientific findings that you found that you wrote an article on.
Uh-huh.
Would you say that was your credence for why you didn't believe in a God? It's a simple question.
It's one of them.
It's okay, cool. That's totally
credence.
Fine. I agree. It's probably not even the best. But I'd like
to also say that if you asked a Christian why they believe, they wouldn't say it's because of one thing. They have a whole network of things to support their beliefs.
Let's just pretend it was the best thing, one of the best reasons. You have a lot, but it was the best one. We can at least, for the sake of argument and a one-hour conversation, we'll just say, hey, this is your best argument for why you think there isn't God. If scientists were to come out tomorrow, and this is through aggressive findings that completely revolutionized our understanding of the universe, determined alternative theories that wasn't God, they didn't say it was God, but they found other means other than evolution for why speciation occurred. They found other evidences that proved that the universe was, and the solar system is much older than just 4.8 billion years, they found reasons for why proteins generated not just through RNA, but through other molecules that could have existed. And that whole list that you just sent became obsolete. Would that at any way change your position?
On God? No.
At least as your best reason, at least that's for your best reason for why God didn't exist.
Well, if it was my, like, you posited an awful lot of things there. You said, if that was my best reason, and then they come along and say that that's not true, then you ask me, if that reason is gone, would you lose your best reason? And the answer is yes, of course I would, if it was my best reason.
Oh, that's perfect. That's exactly the answer you should give, because that's a reasonable conclusion that you would come to if someone said, hey, this argument that you have is no longer good.
Yeah.
That's a great answer, actually. Mm-hmm. What you would find is a lot of people would give their best reasons for why they think a God exists, and when you show that that reasoning is faulty, they would still come up with another reason why, or they would still say they still support that reason.
Yeah.
But I think the benefit here that you just illustrated is that an atheist or a non-believer, in most cases, because they're not using faith as a means to support their beliefs, and evidence instead, when you show the evidence is wrong, they're willing to change their mind or get better evidence.
Well, yeah. Matter of fact, that is built into the scientific method. I mean, people get great rewards and Nobel Prizes for upsetting the apple cart on scientific knowledge. If somebody, if a theist out there, a believer, could find some way to prove that that evolution was not right, or that even a major part of it was not right and wrong, he could earn a Nobel Prize from the scientific community for doing that. They want to be shown where they're wrong. Now figure the theists, the preachers, and the what do you call it, theocrats, they don't want to be shown that they're wrong. Matter of fact, they can't be shown that they're wrong because they can't test their claims, and they count on that.
There's a claim.
So it's possible. I'd like to just drive home one last point. It seems then that the case of why the history of the world is so appealing to you isn't so much that you have a lot of lists of claims by scientists, but instead that you have an evidence-based belief, and that you use that evidence to come to a reasonable conclusion.
Yeah.
And that if someone were to show you different evidence, you'd be willing to change your conclusion, because your claims are based on evidence, and that's what motivates you to have such a high confidence.
That's not even the main reason. I mean, the only reason. The other reason is I'm fascinated by it. I think it's really incredibly cool. I mean, it's incredible to know that type of thing, or at least try to have a good understanding of the science behind where the earth came from, where people came from, where how organics could actually find a way to create life or become life. We haven't actually done the experiments to make, you know, to accumulate the evidence, but we have an awful lot of good theories about it, and I'm sure that before too long, somebody will be able to create a self-replicating molecule in a cell type of environment, just through the lab and the chemicals and chemical reactions in the lab. I mean, the Miller-Urey experiments, it came pretty damn close to it.
Sure. I think the more rigorous the tests, the more confidence you have in them, because you have an evidence-based belief.
Uh-huh.
And so if someone comes and tries to shake, I guess, your confidence in them, you have not only the presence of mind to say, hey, listen, I believe in this because it was very well tested. You're going to have to show me evidence to show contrary, because I have a very good idea or a good claim to support these claims or these beliefs that I have, because they're based on demonstrable, provable, testable statements and tests and experiments. And if you do show them that my beliefs were wrong, then I'm willing to change my mind on the subject because I have a rational point of view. And I think that outweighs more than just having a fascination about it, because I can have a fascination about any God. What really is the crux of it is you have an evidence-based belief system, and that leads you more often than not to the most reasonable state of mind in terms of what to believe in and what not to believe in.
And I just want to, if I could, hit on a small bit about believing and not believing. I came into a discourse with someone over the past about half a week ago or so. It lasted the question, it trailed off. It haven't got a response yet, but it was. I was really sticking trying. I was trying to stick down to differentiate this this spectrum that a lot of people want to use. Theists, I find specifically, that you either you believe or you don't believe or you're not sure, and they put that down into atheist, theist, or agnostic. And I was saying, as I understand it, it's more of a grid. You have a theist, which is a claim, and you have an atheist, which is saying, no, I'm not convinced of that claim. And then you have Gnostic, which is to know, and agnostic, which is to not know. And it's a grid. And the vast majority of people of atheists are probably subscribed as agnostic, atheists.
That's me.
Right, and then so if you have a Gnostic theist, I would just call that dishonest.
Yes.
You know.
But we couldn't seem to agree on that point.
Yeah.
But
you know. I think a lot of it boils down to how highly do you value the truth. And if you find something that doesn't comport with your beliefs, are you willing to change your beliefs? A lot of people will just simply ignore it. Irrational dichotomies. They would develop these irrational dichotomies in their brains, which cause, and if untreated, can cause mental illness. But they keep believing the stuff, even though that they know. Like for instance, let's say that I know that there are evolutionary biologists out there who totally and completely understand evolution, but they also completely believe in the God of the Bible and Genesis and all this other stuff. So how can they possibly believe both? It's got to be some kind of a real problem in their own brain, you know, that they're struggling with this day in and day out, if they're struggling.
It's a painful amount of cognitive dissonance,
which
you described.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
If you are raised in a culture where that's totally fine, then you're a part of like an internal bubble where believing in God and science is totally acceptable. It's only when you either find yourself in contrast with the culture that you're grown up or brought up in or the environment that you're in that you begin to feel some sort of level of discomfort. But otherwise, you can carry cognitive dissonance with you and still be completely happy. And I've seen it before. So there's not all cases of cognitive dissonance need some sort of discomfort. You're totally fine to be completely abstractly contradictory with yourself and be completely happy. And I think, to be perfectly honest with you, all of us, even in this room right now, all of us in this studio, have some sort of experience with cognitive dissonance that we're experiencing right now. And it's not as big of a deal. So it's actually not as rare of a circumstance as we may think.
Yeah. This is the bottom of the hour, so I'm going to have to take a little break here, give station identification. This is the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour with Doubter 5, Riv, and Wombat. And we're on WOZO Radio, 103.9 LPFM, right here in Knoxville, Tennessee. And we're going to play a song for you, one of the atheist songs that I mentioned earlier. And this is called A Glorious Dawn, and it's by the Symphony of Science, and they use verbiage from Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking. So enjoy.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on
how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, or the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
Of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.
You're listening to the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO 103.9 LPFM in Knoxville, Tennessee. Feel free to join in on the conversation at 865-333-5937. That's 865-333-5937. And now, back to the show. Digital Free Thought Radio Hour.
Simply the best.
I tell you what, there, you could melt gold with that voice.
Oh. Good job there, Todd. Okay.
Hey.
Coming back, first we have to talk about the groups a little bit, and then we'll get farther into this topic of abiogenesis and other things. Talk about the free thought groups here in Knoxville. You can't talk about them without talking about the Atheist Society of Knoxville, founded in 2002. November marks our 15th year. ASK now has nearly 700 members. Actually, I think it's over 700 now. It just went over. And you can find them online at KnoxvilleAtheists.org, or you can go directly to meetup.com and look for Knoxville Atheists. Excuse me. It's just that simple. You can also join us in person at our weekly meetup,
awkward,
which happens every Tuesday evening at West Hills Flats and Taps on Kingston Pike near Westtown Mall, where we get together for food, drink, and conversations. That's right. Everybody is welcome as long as you don't come to preach, proselytize, provoke, or punch. Thank you, Matt Dillahunty. Another large free-thinking group here in Knoxville is the Rationalists of East Tennessee. They've been around for almost 20 years. RET has biweekly presentations and discussions at Pellissippi State Campus near the Hardin Valley Road. They meet the first and third Sundays at the Goins Administration Building Cafeteria Annex. And if that's too much to remember, just go to rationalist.org and click on upcoming events and follow the directions. There's also a group in Knoxville called Sunday Assembly, which started in England just a few years ago and spread around the world. It's a no-God church setting for those who have had enough of religion and religious beliefs, but still like the fellowship of a church-type gathering. They only meet once a month in Knoxville, though, and that's on the fourth Sunday. Excuse me. Then there's the Secular Student Alliance, not to leave out the students. The Secular Student Alliance has programs to give camaraderie and community to any free-thinking high school or college students who would like to be involved in the free thought movement or just like to find other free thinkers to hang with. Everybody needs like-minded friends, and atheists are no different. And there's another group, newcomer to the Free Thought groups, which is the Freedom From Religion Foundation. These people meet once a month in Knoxville at Earth Fair, Wednesdays at 7. They represent the East Tennessee area to the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. Those nice people stand up for the separation of church and state and have your rights in mind. Earlier in the show, we said we'd talk about the Knoxville Atheist call-in TV show. It's been on the air for 7 years. It's called Free Thought Forum, and you can see it every Tuesday between 5 and 6 on Comcast Channel 12 or Charter Channel 192. If you don't have cable, you can always watch it streaming online at ctvknox.org. You can also find archives of some of the shows there, where a YouTube fan has been posting them. Just search for 3 words, Free Thought Forum, Knoxville. Also, if you're interested in getting involved with the TV or this radio show, just come to an ASK meetup or an RET meeting and talk to us about it. You could be our next co-host or guest. And that's about it for announcements and groups. We're going to get back to, excuse me, abiogenesis. Did you want to jump on that, Wombat?
Before we get there, I just want to say I dropped a bomb, and no one even mentioned it.
What's that?
I'm talking about cognitive dissonance and how you can have it without having any kind of discomfort at all. And I accused all of you, both you and Riv, that you guys suffer from it too, and you guys, the response was just, oh, well, let's go to a break then. And then you chewed me out for like about 15 minutes, and I'm like, oh, well, fine, I'll back up the claim right now. So, So we talk about cognitive dissonance a lot, especially when it comes to believers, and there's the prevailing assumption sometimes that we may not also suffer from cognitive dissonance as well. And what do we mean by cognitive dissonance? It just means holding two contrasting points of view or mm-hmm. two beliefs that are in direct conflict with each other. Here's an example.
Opposing beliefs. Yeah.
Here's like, and they don't necessarily have to be something that makes you wake up in a cold sweat every night. For example, I hate tomatoes. I can't stand them. I don't want anything to do with them.
Just with salt?
But I love ketchup.
Lightly fried?
I tried some. They're gross. It also probably comes from the time I was working at Burger King and I have to slice them like 24/7 all day long. They're gross little things. But I love
know.
Ketchup.
At Burger King, they may not actually contain tomatoes.
That's something else.
I love ketchup. But you would think... You would think loving
personal opinion.
Ketchup and hating everything that has everything to do with tomatoes, that's a direct conflict with each other. I give you another one. I love baby octopuses. I know this is kind of weird, but I love them. I can watch videos of them all day long, people crawling with them all over their hands. They're adorable. They're cute. I went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium as a kid. Mm-hmm. I saw them. Newborn octopuses, they're the most adorable thing you'll ever see. I swear if you look them up on YouTube, you'll fall in love. I hate, I absolutely despise tiny itty-bitty creatures with 8 legs. Spiders, scorpions, can't stand them. Get them away from me. I can't stand arachnids. I hate tiny little creatures with 8 legs, but I love baby octopuses. That's a direct conflict, and I don't have a problem with it. I'm totally aware of it, but I can go through my whole life without ever worrying about that cognitive dissonance that I have one bit. And I think a lot of people have that.
Well, I do have a thought, but if I may, maybe to help you just to assuage and maybe lend some amelioration there, lessen your conscience a bit, I think it's perfectly, not to say rational, but I think it's consistent to say that you could not like spiders, but do like baby octopuses, because while they might have similar in their ligaments and their body and so on, to say anything with 8 extinctions in one body, you could put that into a lot of different things. So I think it's not inconsistent to say that you're
You like
gargoyles. Don't like arachnids, but do like, so just to, lend some, you don't have to worry about that much, but, but it's just my opinion, but as far as cognitive dissonance goes, I will gladly admit, if you follow the trends and things happening in the nation, I don't want to get too deep into it, otherwise it opens a chasm of Pandora's box, but, things that are happening in the nation around the world, I have to try to keep somewhat of a sunny disposition, somewhat of an optimistic position on it, and try to focus on how science is advancing in every facet, despite all the problems that people are having around the world, especially close to home now, certain circumstances. I err on the side of thinking, well, it'll get better. It'll get better. Even if a particular issue is showing that, no, it maybe won't just yet. I do that because if I don't, I think I'll lose sanity. So there's that, and I can give you a lot more examples.
Yeah, I understand.
What's the cognitive dissonance that you got? Let's go around the table before we start to break down life as we know it, literally.
Do I have any? I'm sure I do. I can't think of any offhand. I don't know. Maybe I'll think of some. Matter of fact, you've given me something to think about. Maybe I'll write an article if I can come up with any. But I am just so sane. You know, I can't.
You're just perfectly rational. Right. We just can't do anything about you. You're perfect.
That's it. But I'm sure I can think of some when I have time. But right now, nothing is coming to me.
How about this? If you had a kid and you were raising the kid, would you tell that kid to ride her or his bicycle with a helmet?
I probably would.
Do you ride a bicycle with a helmet?
I ride a motorcycle, and you can be sure I have a helmet on.
Yeah, but I mean a bicycle. When you normally ride a bicycle, would you have a helmet on?
Probably not.
Probably not.
I probably wouldn't.
There could be some sort of inconsistency there.
Yeah.
If you care about the well-being of people in general,
think that I have
and you don't do it for yourself?
More knowledge of the road and experience in riding the roads that I would be able to find and see danger.
Oh, yeah,
because you
have so much knowledge, your head's made out of, you know, titanium, so if you fall, there's no way you can ever get injured.
Or get run into. That's why I ride it when I ride my motorcycle.
Okay. I'm also not making any references to any. There's a number of people who are wearing casts while performing this radio show right now, and it's not me and it's not Riff. So I think we should all learn from being a little bit more cautious, especially if we would advise other people to do so. But I feel like there's some stemming cognitive dissonance there where you certainly do care about the welfare of others as well as yourself, but there's limits to how far you go to taking care of yourself, because you can be eluded for other reasons into a false sense of security.
Yeah.
But I think it's still something that we're all vulnerable to, and I think that's okay. I just want to highlight that, you know, people who do suffer from cognitive dissonance, even when it's something as stark as the universe being created through natural processes, as well as a supernatural being that caused those natural causes to occur, how one person can hold those two ideas in their head at the same time, I think we can do so just as casually as we can with our own. And maybe that's a better frame of reference to go at it rather than saying, oh, they must be sweating and terrible. Maybe there's some people just like, oh, God made everything and science is true. The end. Yeah. Going to work the next day.
Yeah. Okay. Abiogenesis. You're
abiogenesis.
You're a biochemical engineer. Is that correct?
I'm a PhD biochemist.
Okay. So what
newly mentioned, I break down chemical weapons for a living.
What can you... What light can you show on abiogenesis for us?
So the big question in evolutionary science, not evolutionary science, truly it's its own field, it's called abiogenesis, is how did we go from no life as we defined it, life being, you know, something that can replicate, something that can keep sources of fuel of some sort.
Yeah, consumes fuel and produce waste.
Yeah, and produce waste to a certain extent. And there's a lot of different definitions of how, you know, what kind of waste is qualified. But basically, can it replicate and can it consume material in order to propagate? And then the question of, you know, sentience is its own issue. But really, life doesn't necessarily need to be sentient. doesn't need to be something that can talk to you. Doesn't need to be something that can
breathe. An amoeba.
We have a lot of different.
But it's alive.
As far as we're aware, it's a big claim to start.
Well, it doesn't have a nervous system, so it would be hard for it to be nervous. I mean, nervous. Hard to be aware. And the thing about it is our virus is live. You know, they don't consume food and produce waste, but they do replicate.
So what we're learning is, because we've defined life to be certain things, it gives us an objective standard to say what is alive and what isn't. But there are definitely things that have traits of life, but since it lacks one of the qualifications, it's not considered life by technicality, but not necessarily out of effort. There's definitely some great things about mitochondria, viruses, that a lot of people would say, this thing is replicating, it's consuming, it's being able to process its own progeny through some sort of genetic code, but because it can't do it on its own, and that it needs another system, a host, in order to propagate itself, we can't consider that life. But it seems to have every other facet to life aside from that. So there are definitely things that are in the gray area. But we come up with strict definitions to help us come up with concrete examples of what we're talking about in science. And it turns out the mystery of how things go from non-life to life is still trying to be determined. We don't know. But that doesn't mean that we don't have very good clues that are helping us get a better resolution of what happened.
Yes.
And so what we are understanding is the better we are able to interpret what life was like in the early stages, like primordial era, the better we're able to understand how the turn from things not necessarily or things falling outside of our strict definition of life, the things falling within our definition of life began. And it wasn't over the span of one, you know, quick generation. We think there's probably a long period where we had cells that aren't what we would consider cells today, because they're essentially without what we would consider a cell wall. And a cell wall is really great because it contains all the nifty things that a cell uses to keep itself alive. But the cells way back when were very porous or non-existent at all. And what you had was essentially a collection of different basic molecules that are capable of reforming. And over a period of time, those were able to form into a consistent structure that helped to basically fulfill its own propagation. And it doesn't sound like it's a satisfying answer, because it's not supposed to be. All it is just a machinery that's essentially doing a basic function.
Uh-huh. Right.
Proteins are essentially just long chains of molecules that have a particular shape to them. And sometimes that shape can look a lot like a hammer, or for a better extent, it can look like a nail. And a nail can be used for one thing, or like being hammered into a wall, which is what we would think of when we see a nail. But if we were way back when, before even hammers existed, a nail would just be a sharp piece of metal. And a sharp piece of metal could have other uses other than hammering into a wall. You can use a sharp piece of metal as a toothpick. You can use a sharp piece of metal as a compass needle. You can use a sharp piece of metal as a sewing needle. There's a lot of different purposes for, like, these very basic shapes. And what you had back then in the primordial era was a lot of these basic shapes that had multiple facets of functionality to them. And some areas, there was enough basic shapes that are around each other that you were able to develop something that we would call a working system that was capable of deriving energy from its surroundings. And that took a very long time to occur. And meanwhile, because the cells are so porous, and I'm sorry if this is a really long explanation, but because the cells are so porous, other units that were capable of propagating themselves and also deriving energy from their environment came into closer contact with each other. And that's when you start to have this concept of a cell as we understand it today, where you have different working units nearby each other that propagate themselves for the benefit of themselves. And there's no mental process required in here. It's just, at best, as far as we can claim, it's just something that occurs as a phenomenon when you have a lot of these functional groups together. Like, it's literally like throwing a bunch of blocks on the ground millions and millions of years, and then sometimes they're going to fall into a castle formation. And they're like, oh, that's a castle. That's cool. And then it'll collapse. And then you throw them again, and sometimes you'll get a shape of a tower or a different kind of castle. but you'll do it again and again until sometime you get something that sticks. And once you have something that sticks, that stick or that thing that sticks can reform or help or stick around and be sturdy enough so that the next time the bricks fall, something else forms, like another building,
they all
or
have
another
to,
house.
They all have to respond to their environment, too. If the environment changes,
exactly,
you know, they could make a good brick wall in one environment, then the environment changes and they have to reconfigure. But it's not a cognitive thing. It's not something they think about. It's just the way that the dice rolls in the new environment and how they replicate and form again and which structures are more conducive to longevity and reproduction.
Right.
And
other natural processes, as we're aware of it, it takes a long time for that to occur.
Right.
Rich, sorry
for
interrupting.
Oh, no. Just something that came to mind was talking about adaptation to this environment and it has to do with evolution, but just kind of a small side point that people are sometimes claiming, well, we've never seen it happen. One, no, we have plenty of examples. One of the ones that comes to mind is, was it in England back in the early 1800s or late 1800s?
Mm-hmm.
You had the Industrial
Revolution.
And you had basically moths, mm-hmm. and the white ones could be spotted easier from birds of prey, and they were picked off. But the
because of the soot coating everything.
Right, and because the ones that adapted to that color, they were darker, they could blend in, mm-hmm. and they survived. Next thing you know, there are a lot less white moths and a lot more soot-colored moths, and then as things cleared up, they went back to... I mean, it just you see it happening all around you.
Right.
Fruit flies, for example, fruit flies, I mean... And they have a lot shorter lifespan, so they're a lot greater for seeing the process of evolution happen much expeditiously. So,
yep.
It's all around us. Mm-hmm. We just need to look for it.
Yeah, I remember one time, who was it? That woman was running for vice president under, she was an Alaskan native.
Oh.
What's her name?
Palin?
Palin, right.
Yeah.
She once got.
Oh my God! Why did you forget her?
Yeah, she really. It was just the name that escaped me. But she got in front of a microphone one time and berated, you know, the scientific community and the government for supporting them in their study of fruit flies. So we spend millions of dollars a year studying fruit flies. What for? We need to take that money away. Well, fruit flies have a very short lifespan, and it's really easy to demonstrate evolutionary traits and paths when you recombine them in experimentation. It may be that she's smarter than we think and just wanted to defund science and evolution, but more likely she just took it at face value and said we shouldn't be wasting money on studying flies, for that matter.
It seems like there's a kind of a disconcerting limitation of concern where someone might think, does this make me profit? Therefore, it's not worth the time. It just completely
mm-hmm.
misses
right.
over the whole point of what the bigger picture
yeah.
is.
Of general progress.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll get your profit. You'll get your advances once we know more science. It's almost one of those things where one supports the other, but that point is completely missed, and it's frustrating. Sorry, kind of derailed there a bit. It's just something that came to mind.
No, you're fine. I want to try one more stab at this. I think I was a little bit long in the tooth, but essentially life is kind of like a building, and it didn't show up in one day. Instead, over time, we were able to, or phenomenons were able to create the natural building blocks of life, and when they were arranged in a sturdy enough fashion, they were able to accumulate to the point where we have the first sign of life that we would call life today. And that form of life was able to continue to evolve until eventually we have what we have now. And it's a really, really cool process, but we don't know the intricacies of it yet. But the exciting thing is we're still looking it up today, and there's still more things to discover. And if you want to be, anyone who's listening, if you want to be the person who discovers how life came to be, that award is waiting for you, and we're getting closer every day. So I encourage everyone to go out and try to find out as much as they can about the subject, because the more support we have in trying to figure these things out, the more benefits we'll reap from it in the future.
Right, and more universities are dropping the tuitions way down or making them free. Even if you can't get to a university, you can get to the Internet, and you can research all of these topics that we've been talking about tonight. Just do some research on valid sources and dive in. Remember, your education didn't end with the last day of school.
Something really quickly came to mind about, went back to cognitive dissonance and talking about colleagues and so on and so on. If someone follows evolution and they're open and they're following the evidence and everything is checking out, but they also happen to believe the Bible and whatever interpretation of the thousands that you can take from it, interesting to ask them might be, at what point in evolution did Adam and Eve come along? I mean, it's kind of one of those questions of, you can't, it's incompatible. It's not tenable.
Yeah. If you follow the matronly and patronly lines, there is a biological Eve, because there was a funneling, bottleneck of humanity at one time when there was only like 10,000 individuals. And all of them, the female RNA came from that one woman. But there's probably a man too, but we can't trace it. And it's the likelihood that they lived at the same time is very small. Anyway, down to 2 minutes in the show. Any final words?
We talked about a lot of cool stuff. If anyone wants to look up abiogenesis, go for it. And I also recommend the Science Labs podcast on mitochondria. Check that out if you really want to have a really colorful explanation for how scientists currently think life generated from no life.
Okay. Riff?
Just as always, be well, do good, and think critically.
Mm-hmm. Be well, write often, and do good work.
Oh, yeah. The at Garrison Keillor.
Right,
be
right.
Well, do good works, and keep in touch.
Right, there you go.
That was kind of the inspiration.
And I'll sign off here. We're thanking Wombat and Riv for being on the show. Say bye.
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 And remember, everyone's going to somebody else's hell. The time to worry about is when you have evidence that they exist. And souls. We have no evidence that they exist. So, we'll see you next week, Wednesday at 7 o'clock on this same station, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye!